Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Christine Sandy, the Program Director of the Rural Health Information Hub, and I'd like to welcome you to today's webinar on supportive services and caregiving for our rural older adults. We are happy to be collaborating with the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services on today's webinar. And I will quickly run through some housekeeping items before we begin. We hope to have time for your questions at the end of the webinar. If you do have questions for our presenters, please submit those at the end of the webinar using the Q&A section that will appear on the lower right-hand corner of the screen following the presentations. We've provided a PDF copy of the presentation on the RHI Hub website, and that's accessible through the URL on your screen, and we also have put the link in the chat function. If you have technical issues during the webinar, please call WebEx support at 866-229-3239. Now to tell us a bit more about the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services and give us some background on today's speaker, I would like to introduce Paul Moore. Paul Moore currently serves as the Executive Secretary for the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services. He is also a Senior Health Policy Advisor at the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. Paul brings a lifetime of experience related to rural health care from both his family heritage and more than 30 years in community and hospital pharmacy. His experience reaches beyond pharmacy, as he was also the CEO of a county healthcare authority consisting of one of the nation's earliest critical access hospitals, the county EMS, a physician clinic, and a home health agency. Paul is also a past president of the National Rural Health Association. And with that, I'll turn it over to Paul.
Well, thank you, Christine. I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome our audience again to today's webinar on supportive services and caregiving for older rural adults by the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services. In this webinar, we will provide an overview of the committee, highlight rural-urban disparities across aging and health, discuss rural community infrastructure, and hear about the committee's site visit and policy recommendations. But first, I'd like to provide some brief background on the committee, especially for those joining today's webinar who may not know who we are. The committee, chartered back in 1987, is an independent citizens panel whose charge is to advise the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services on healthcare challenges that affect rural Americans. The committee consists of 21 members, including the chair, and the experiences and expertise they bring reflects a wide variety of rural issues in public health, medicine, nursing, human service delivery, hospital administration, child care, research, finance, law, and business. Since 1987, the committee has continued its work to address and examine pertinent issues that affect the health and well-being of rural Americans, and to also hear directly from rural stakeholders. Then, following its meetings, the committee produces policy briefs for the Secretary of Health and Human Services with recommendations on policy or regulatory matters under the Secretary's purview. For its 85th meeting in April 2019, the committee met in Sacramento, California, and focused on supportive services and caregiving for older adults in rural areas as one of the two topics. During the meeting, the committee examined the availability, accessibility, and acceptability of supportive services for older adults in rural communities, in addition to some of the federal programs currently being leveraged to address this issue. On the first day of the two-and-a-half-day meeting, the entire committee heard firsthand from organizations and experts on the subject, just as you will hear from during this webinar. On the second day, the subcommittee tasked with this issue conducted a site visit at Sierra Nevada Memorial Hospital, located in Grass Valley in Nevada County, California. Now, we have hyperlinked the brief. If you will click on the cover, I'll get that for you there. If you'll click on this cover, it will take you to the policy brief, or you can also find it along with others at the link provided at the bottom of the slide. So you might say, why supportive services and caregiving? Well, serving the rural elderly as a topic was the first human services topic taken on after the Secretary expanded the committee's charter to include human services way back in 2004. Life expectancy in the United States has risen since the 2004 report was sent to the Secretary, bringing with it new challenges in providing both short and long-term care for an aging nation. The effects of these challenges are especially pronounced in rural America, where the proportion of older adults, those ages 65 years and older, has been steadily increasing and outpacing the proportion living in urban areas. The aging of rural America has been well documented, including the fact that rural areas have higher rates of poverty, multiple chronic conditions, and age-adjusted mortality for all causes. An understanding of the current supportive service and caregiving policies affecting the care of older adults, especially rural older adults, will be helpful for those and for the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy within Health and Human Services and other stakeholders to address issues of healthy aging. So to transition us into learning more about this disease, I want to briefly introduce the experts presenting on today's webinar. First, we will hear from Marcus Escobedo. He is Vice President of Communications and the Senior Program Officer at the John A. Hartford Foundation, where he develops and implements the foundation's communications strategy. Joining the foundation in 2006 as a member of the program team, he maintains a grants portfolio of initiatives to improve hospital care of older adults, including in the emergency department and surgical settings. He served as a member of the Community Advisory Board of the Geriatric Emergency Department Innovations through workforce, informatics, and structural enhancements, a project at Mount Sinai Medical Center. He has previously served on the board of One Stop Senior Services in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, as well as the Regional Health Equity Council as part of the Office of Minority Health's National Partnership for Action to End Health Disparities. That's in Region 2. Following Marcus will be Dr. Octavio Martinez, Jr., a former National Advisory Committee member. He is the fifth executive director to lead the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health since its creation in 1940, some 79, 80 years ago. The Foundation's grants and programs support mental health services, research, policy analysis, and public education projects in Texas. The Hogg Foundation is part of the Division of Diversity and Community Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. And Dr. Martinez holds an appointment of Associate Vice President within the division. He is also an affiliate faculty member with an appointment in the University School of Social Work, and he holds an adjunct professor appointment at the University of Texas Health Sciences Center at San Antonio School of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. He has formerly served on the Institute of Medicine's Committee on the Governance and Financing of Graduate Medical Education and on the Committee on the Mental Health Workforce for Geriatric Populations. So with those two introductions, let me turn it over to Marcus. Marcus, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Paul. It's a real pleasure to be on this webinar, and I applaud the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services for thinking about and trying to address issues related to rural aging. I grew up in a very small town outside of Corpus Christi, Texas. My dad's 81. My mom is 76. So the issues related to making sure they get quality health care and supportive services in their community is both personal and of professional interest to me. So thank you. It's great to be here. So I'll dive in, again, very excited to be here with you all. Let me tell you first just a little bit about the John A. Hartford Foundation. We were established in 1929 by the family owners of the A&P grocery store chain. And for more than three decades, we've had one singular focus, which is on improving care for older adults. That remains our mission today, and we have three priority areas in which we try to meet that mission. We work to create age-friendly health systems. That's both a broad concept and a specific initiative, which I'll dive into in more detail today. We support family caregivers of older adults, and we work to improve serious illness and end-of-life care. These are all interlocking areas with lots of overlap. We give out about $20 million a year to excellent nonprofit organizations and academic institutions that are working in these three areas. Why do we focus on aging and older adults? And part of that is demography. And as you can see here on the left-hand side, we have a radical changing both in the United States and around the world in terms of our makeup of people by age group. And as you can see here in 1960, older adults were just a sliver of the population in this country. As we proceed to 2060, you can see in particular how the 75 and up, the 85 plus group, it's going to expand quite dramatically in a very short period of time. That means that we, all of us in society, need to think about how we better meet the needs of that aging population. And so on the right, you see a response that we've seen happen, again, both globally and here in the United States, and that is work to create what we call an age-friendly social movement or an age-friendly ecosystem. That includes that we need age-friendly policies at the center of all of this. We need our regulations, our laws, everything that we're doing in society to really have a focus on meeting the needs of the growing population of older adults. It means we need age-friendly cities and communities, and we give good credit to the WHO and to AARP for establishing a movement to have cities and communities become age-friendly. Even states now are becoming age-friendly. That means redesigning the environment, having services in place, and just rethinking the way that we have our communities, cities, and states designed to better meet the needs of older adults. It also means having public health that is age-friendly. And I'll say a little bit more about this at the end, but it's another important area for this audience, I think, to be aware of, that there is a movement in public health to think more about older adults in the context of what that field can do. And then what I'll dive into today is the role of the health system and how it can be more age-friendly for all of us as we get older. So I'll dive into that specific initiative, age-friendly health systems, now, and I'm so glad to say that the framework that I'll be talking about that is the foundation for age-friendly health systems was embedded into the policy report from the advisory committee that you'll hear more about today, and the concepts and the framework that I'll be discussing really do apply broadly, not only to healthcare delivery, but to the supportive services delivered by community-based organizations, by public health. There's really here's something for everyone. But the specific initiative, Age-Friendly Health Systems, is led by the John A. Hartford Foundation and the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, a terrific national quality improvement organization based in Boston. And we work in partnership with the American Hospital Association and the Catholic Health Association of the United States. But what I will say is that this has really grown beyond an initiative. We really have a movement, and you'll see in a moment many more partners and stakeholders involved, and we hope you will join us. But why age-friendly health systems? I've talked a bit about demography driving a lot of our reason for why the healthcare system needs to better meet the needs of older people. With aging comes complexity, and our healthcare system right now doesn't do a great job in addressing that complexity. You think about layering on issues in rural settings, and that becomes even more important. A third reason is really disproportionate harm that we see in our healthcare settings, and we're doing everything we can to reduce that harm. And finally, we know we have a no-do gap. We have many evidence-based geriatric models of care, yet they only reach a very small portion of the older adults and the family members who could benefit. So we looked at that challenge of why we weren't having these evidence-based models more available to older adults in need. And one of the key drivers behind not having that dissemination is really that healthcare is so complex, and there's so many things that healthcare providers have to do. And so we challenged a group of experts in geriatric care, along with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, our foundation staff, and health systems themselves to think about the common elements of the evidence-based models that we've seen out in the field that really do work. And so they identified 90 discrete core features in these evidence-based models. We challenged them to find redundancies and similar concepts and to streamline those models. And they came out with 13 core features that were really essential. We challenged this group even further. We said in healthcare, 13 is even too much to do. So where we came out with were the vital few and the four M's of age-friendly care, which I will go through now. If you take anything from this presentation, here's what I hope you will take away. It's the 4Ms framework that this amazing group of partners have developed, and it's now rolling out across the country. The 4Ms are what matters: medication, mentation, and mobility. What matters? When we say that in healthcare, and again, this is about supportive services as well, about public health, about everything we're dealing with older adults, we want to know and align care with each older adult's specific health outcome goals and their care preferences. And this does, of course, include end-of-life care, but we're thinking beyond end-of-life care. So this is not just about advanced care planning, but really about understanding the goals and preferences of every older adult in every care setting and having all care aligned towards what matters. On medication, we always say, if medication is necessary, and that if is very important. We know that too many older adults are on too many medications, which cause a number of harms and potential problems. But if a medication is necessary, we ask in our healthcare systems that are age-friendly to use age-friendly medication that does not interfere with what matters, mobility or mentation across the settings of care. Mentation is about preventing, identifying, treating, and managing dementia, depression, and delirium across settings of care. In primary care and outpatient setting, we focus primarily on dementia and depression. In the hospital, we focus on delirium, which is an acute state of confusion that is incredibly dangerous and harmful to older adults and is also very costly to the system. Finally, mobility is moving beyond just falls prevention to ensuring that older adults move safely every day in order to maintain their function and do what matters. Those are the 4 M's of age-friendly care, and I hope those will stay with you. Why do we have these 4 M's? One, to build on a strong evidence base, as I mentioned, pulling from the literature. They do address older adults' core health issues. They are about simplifying and reducing burden in healthcare around implementation and measurement. Very importantly, these 4 M's are reinforcing of one another. What's novel and unique about this approach and this framework is that we're asking every healthcare setting, every time with every older adult, to think about all 4 M's together. We're finding that most healthcare systems are actually addressing the 4 M's with evidence-based practices, but this is a way to organize that thinking, organizing the work so that we get the best outcomes possible for older adults. We know these 4 M's impact key quality and safety outcomes for people who are aging. We have a bold aim as part of this initiative. We're trying to build a social movement so that all care with older adults is age-friendly. And that means it's guided by this essential set of evidence-based practices, these 4 M's, that it causes no harms, that it's consistent with what matters to older adults and their families. And we have bold aims in terms of how many healthcare practices and hospitals we want to reach. We are well on our way to meeting our goal of 1,000 hospitals and practices being age-friendly by the end of next year. And then by 2023, we hope to be in 2,500 hospitals and practices, and I should say we will be there because this movement is taking off. I want to give credit to the healthcare systems who are pioneers in helping us develop the 4Ms model: Anne Arundel Medical Center in Maryland, Ascension, Kaiser Permanente, Providence St. Joseph Health, and Trinity Health were amazing partners at the outset, helping us crystallize these 4Ms and identifying the evidence-based practices that are feasible, that are implementable, that are now being spread across our age-friendly health system sites. There are many gateways into age-friendly care and support, and I'm primarily focusing today on institution-based care in hospitals and in long-term care settings as well. But ambulatory primary care is another important area that I'll reference that's including retail pharmacy. We have an exciting partnership with CVS MinuteClinic and Case Western Reserve Nursing that will be rolling out age-friendly care through that network. And then again, I want to emphasize the role of community-based organizations and public health in thinking about the 4 M's. But you may be wondering, how does this get operationalized? What happens on the ground? Here is an example that I won't go into too much detail about, but the key elements are taking those four M's, which we know are evidence-based, which we know have great impact, and it's about two things, assessing those four M's and then acting on them. And here you can see some of the activities that a hospital or primary care practice would take in asking what matters, documenting it, or reviewing medications, screening for delirium and mobility, and then very importantly, acting on those screens to actually put in place evidence-based practices that can make a difference in the lives of older adults based on those four M's. Same thing in primary care. You can see this very feasible, implementable way to address the four M's in care. And even further to the right, if we extended this out, would be a list of, a menu almost, of evidence-based practices that you can easily implement in your healthcare setting to get to those four M's. Measurement is a huge deal in healthcare. I will not go into details about this, but just to say that in any healthcare system that's involved, we are not trying to add to the measurement burden, but rather using existing measures for both outcomes and processes, mapping those to the four M's in age-friendly care to make this as easy to implement as possible. What's a vehicle for health systems, either hospitals, clinics, long-term care settings, wanting to become more involved? One mechanism is through action communities. These are 7-month learning opportunities that are freely available to healthcare teams around the country, and we are encouraging rural healthcare teams very much to be involved. The opportunity includes monthly interactive webinars where there's education around the four M's and those evidence-based practices. There's opportunity to share progress and learnings with your peers in other healthcare settings. There's in-person meetings as well as ways to submit data and get feedback on the approach to care being used at different healthcare settings. There's ongoing coaching. It's a great opportunity that we're getting very good feedback from teams who are joining this learning collaborative. There will be more coming out over the next year, and I'll at the end show you how you can stay involved and learn about more action communities. The movement's growing. We're very excited. I mentioned we're trying to get to 1,000 hospitals and healthcare practices by the end of next year, and already we have 446 teams in 49 states engaged with us. Wyoming is the one place that we did not have a team, but we soon will. I'm happy to announce that we'll have presence in Wyoming over this next year. Here are the levels of designation for our Age-Friendly Health Systems Initiative. We have 247 teams and sites across the country that have described how they are meeting the four M's and that allows them to designate themselves as a participant. Even further, we have 117 that have gone the extra step of providing data around the numbers of older adults and how they're being reached with 4M care. I mentioned that this movement is growing. We have many stakeholders engaged with us, and this just gives you a snapshot of some of the many partners who have joined in the movement, and we encourage each of you in your respective roles to join us as well. I'll note with HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, we've been terrific partners with us in what's called their Geriatrics Workforce Enhancement Program, which have many rural sites around the country that are engaging directly in the age-friendly health systems work. They are training primary care clinicians in geriatric care, using the four M's, doing outreach and training, and it is an exciting partnership that I hope you all can learn more about. Basically, age-friendly health system is really about beginning and ending at the kitchen table. I want to go back and reemphasize, I did not talk much about community-based organizations, the supportive services, public health, the role of other kinds of stakeholders in delivering age-friendly care, but it's absolutely a component to the initiative and becoming more and more important. But this is a worldwide health and social movement that, again, we hope you all will join. And here's how you can do that. Visit ihi.org/age-friendly. You can learn more about these action communities. I know for some of you, you're not in a healthcare setting, but please share this information with your local healthcare organizations and invite them to join. We are also now having organizations run their own action communities. In New York State, we will actually have a hospital association running an action community. And if your state or region is interested, we can help you learn how to facilitate your own action community for healthcare teams wanting to become age-friendly. We have free free resources that are available. So, again, on this site, you can download guides to using the 4Ms, guides for the return on investment. And then finally, what I encourage each of you to do is to sign up for our Friends of Age-Friendly quarterly update calls. These are great ways to stay engaged in the initiative, learn more about what's happening. And we have many different kinds of stakeholders who join those calls. I'm going to end slightly veering off from age-friendly health systems, but just noting a few other areas that the foundation is focused on rural aging. As was presented by Paul early on, this is an incredibly important area where we will be investing more resources in over the next several years. I've mentioned our age-friendly health systems, but we've worked on expanding other models like PACE, Programs of All-Inclusive Care of the Elderly, which helps keep older adults out of nursing homes. We've worked to expand depression care models in rural communities. I mentioned the Geriatrics Workforce Enhancement Program, which 30 of those sites around the country are rural, and I encourage you to check that out and learn more about what's happening in your community. We have other initiatives as well, and finally, I do want to end on the Health Affairs Special Theme Issue that just came out in December 2019, which we at the John A. Hartford Foundation helped to sponsor. It is an incredible resource of research and policy recommendations around rural issues broadly and about rural aging as well, and encourage you to take a look at that theme issue and learn as much as you can. I know we will here at the Foundation and be continuing to focus on the needs of rural older adults. With that, let me thank you. This is our vision across all of our priority areas that we want accessible, affordable health care for all older adults, including those in rural communities, that deliver high-quality, high-value services that matter most. I really appreciate being here with you all today, and let me turn it right over to Octavio Martinez, who will now take it from here. Thanks very much.
Great presentation, Marcus. To everyone on this webinar, this is Dr. Martinez. Welcome, and thank you for tuning in today. I'm delighted to present the committee recommendations as a former member of the committee myself. Before we go over the recommendations, I would like to talk more about the site visit that we took on the second day of the National Advisory Meeting. Grass Valley is a rural community in Nevada County, California, located in Gold Country in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Grass Valley has a population of approximately 13,000 residents, according to the United States Census data. It is designated as a medically underserved population, a primary care health professional shortage area, and a high-needs geographic mental health professional shortage area. The committee site visit to Grass Valley was hosted by Sierra Nevada Memorial Hospital, which has operated in Nevada County since 1958. Services provided by the hospital range from family medicine to cancer care and emergency services, but they also provide outreach programs on Alzheimer's disease and caregiver support. The California Area Agency on Aging, Planning and Service Area 4, as well as the Freed Center for Independent Living were also instrumental in recruiting service providers and consumers to attend the site visit, including Gold Country Community Services, Helping Hands Adult Day Program, Chapa Day Indian Help, Hospitality House, Hospice of the Foothills, Elder Care Providers Coalition of Nevada County, Falls Prevention Coalition of Nevada County, and Partners in Care. Stakeholders from the California Area Agency on Aging, Gold Country Community Services, Chapa Day Indian Health, Partners in Care, and Hospice of the Foothills all expressed transportation as a significant barrier for older adults who wish to receive their services. A lack of transportation was also noted as a limitation on seniors' food and nutritional choices, and social isolation forced some older adults to walk significant distances to receive certain services. Representatives from Hospitality House and the Helping Hands Adult Day Program said the community used to have a centralized senior center, but it closed years ago and hindered the ability to provide services from a well-accessed and centralized location. They noted the uptick in people who are homeless as a growing issue in the community, as over 30% of the homeless population are 55 years of age or older. Attendees representing Chapa Day and Hospice of the Foothills noted that primary care, dental, behavioral health, and nutrition assistance were some of the most utilized care offerings in the area. But other important services, for example, case management and patient navigation, were provided without reimbursement. Individuals who worked for the Freed Center for Independent Living discussed the effects of recent wildfires in the region as particularly detrimental to older adults and those living with disabilities. Those who were affected that lost their homes had no other options other than going to an assisted living facility. The Elder Care Providers and Falls Prevention Coalitions of Nevada County mentioned that the area has still not recovered from the economic effects of the 2008 recession, particularly a resource center dedicated to providing training and respite care services for caregivers was forced to close. They noted stigma in accessing services as a great barrier to care for their older adults. Person-centered planning programs for those aging in their area have been introduced to combat stigma and improve participation in local aging services, but they are understaffed and require additional services to be more effective. Over the course of the meeting and site visit, the committee developed a sense of the importance of a complete care continuum focused on improved health outcomes for older adults living in rural areas. Although traditional definitions of supported services and caregiving generally fall under the human services category of long-term services and supports programs, the committee recognized that both health services and human services have an interconnected role in the provision of care for older Americans. This idea is reflected in the following recommendations to the Secretary. The national and state policy experts that presented to the committee emphasized the difficulties caused by fragmentation of care across multiple funding streams and programs. Disjointed care systems for older Americans places the burden of navigating the options on the individual and their family, and it limits the possibility of optimizing resources. On the final day of the meeting, the committee concluded that health and human service programs should be designed to allow rural older adults to age in place in a manner that is accessible, available, and acceptable to the needs of each individual. These themes laid the framework for the committee's first three recommendations on providing access to the Older Americans Act resources, expanding telehealth services, and promoting age-friendly communities and health systems in rural health initiatives at the federal level. For the first recommendation, the committee recommends the Secretary create a comprehensive resource on the aging and long-term services and supports available to older adults in rural areas. The Administration on Aging offers information on long-term services and supports programs through its approximately 30 national resource centers. However, a recent GAO report on rural service providers noted that these resources are dispersed across many platforms and could be difficult to locate for service administrators, caregivers, and those receiving care. This was evident during the committee site visit in rural Northern California, where local health service providers expressed that community members did not know what services are available, so they are not getting the assistance they need to plan for aging in their community. Additionally, the GAO reported that the Administration for Community Living does not currently offer a resource specifically for older adults in rural areas, nor is there the ability to search for rural caregiving options across existing programs and resources. The committee agrees with the GAO analysis as it aligns with their observations during its meeting and suggests that information barriers could be addressed by synthesizing the Administration for Community Living program offerings into a coordinated and more accessible resource tailored to the unique needs of rural older adults. For the second recommendation, the committee recommends the Secretary continue to expand flexibility in Medicare telehealth billing and provide a comprehensive resource of telehealth offerings in rural areas. Medicare reimbursement for telehealth services remains a barrier in rural settings, particularly the fixed-rate facility fee paid to originating site providers. For calendar year 2019, the payment amount for the telehealth originating site facility fee is 80% of the lesser of the actual charge, or $26.15. The committee believes the Secretary should consider a cost-based reimbursement approach, which would align with the payment model for rural facilities such as critical access hospitals. There is precedent for this, for providing cost-based reimbursement for telehealth in the Frontier Community Health Integration Project demonstration, where participating critical access hospitals received a reimbursement through Medicare at 101% of the cost of the telehealth services provided. The 2018 interim report to Congress on the Frontier Community Health Integration Project noted a 70% increase in telehealth for distant site providers across multiple specialties only 1 year after this reimbursement change. The Frontier Community Health Integration Project participants did note, however, that the greatest implementation challenges were due to credentialing specialists, pointing up another barrier the Secretary should address to improve access to rural telehealth services. Navigating and accessing telehealth options in rural settings is difficult due to the lack of a complete geographic inventory of telehealth services offered. Registries such as the Telehealth Connect and the Telehealth Service Provider Directory do exist, but they are not comprehensive and rely on voluntary reporting and registration. They also require provider consent. In order for these services to be effective, rural older adults and patients must know where to find them. For the third recommendation, the committee recommends the Secretary ensure the promotion and encouragement of age-friendly concepts within rural health grant programs. The committee heard from experts on national aging policy who stressed that age-friendly care results in concordant care, improved health, and cost-effective services. Health and Human Services systems should align care with the health goals and preferences of the older adult, including whether or not they wish to age in place and receive care in their community. The committee learned of two frameworks that could be used for age-friendly capacity building in rural settings. You already heard from Marcus of the 4M framework of mobility, medication, mentation, and what matters. And another one is the CDC's Healthy Brain Initiative created by its Alzheimer's Disease and Healthy Aging Program. The committee is of the opinion that the principles of these frameworks should be incorporated into federal rural health grant funding initiatives and notes that Health and Human Services has precedence for including age-friendly concepts into its notice of funding opportunities within HRSA programs. For the fourth recommendation, the committee recommends the Secretary explore the entry of Medicare Advantage dual-eligible special needs plans into rural areas, identify potential barriers, and work with states to adopt policies that encourage or expand the reach of these plans to rural beneficiaries. Currently, delivery of health care and supportive services in rural communities is a fragmented system spread across multiple organizations and funding streams. Because federal and state-level programs are often not person-centered, and because Medicare does not cover long-term services and supports, people have difficulty navigating and financing services on their own. The traditional fee-for-service model is shifting to promote better organization and care navigation through integrated managed care-based programs. However, the shift is primarily occurring in urban areas where insurance and service options are more readily available. Dual-eligible individuals living in rural areas are the most affected by the urban-rural discrepancy, and they are often the sickest and most vulnerable individuals in the population. Dual-eligible special needs plans were created as a Medicare Advantage option to integrate Medicare and Medicaid for dual-eligible enrollees. Despite the fact that dual-eligible special needs plans are the most common form of integrated plan for dual-eligibles, there is a lack of published research on the availability of dual-eligible special needs plans in rural areas, and Medicare Advantage enrollment as a whole has lagged in rural areas compared to urban. The committee believes further research is needed on the role of dual-eligible special needs plans and integrating care for rural enrollees. The committee also believes that adjustments to federal and state policies regarding dual-eligible special needs plans could promote expansion into rural settings. Issues that the committee felt were more general or were not rule-specific have also been included within the policy considerations portion of the brief. In addition to the specific recommendations above, the committee offers the Secretary the following policy considerations. Number one, collaborating and integrating strategic efforts across federal agencies. Number two, emphasizing the importance of non-emergency medical transportation. Number three, supporting the reauthorization of the Older Americans Act. Number four, including social isolation within the Healthy People 2030 framework. Number five, valuing the need for peer navigators in the care delivery process. and number 6, promoting and expanding unpaid caregiver support programs. With that, I want to thank you all for listening about the committee's experience at Sierra Nevada Memorial Hospital and the policy recommendations and considerations put forward. I will now turn things back over to Paul to provide his concluding thoughts. Paul?
Thank you, Octavio, and Marcus, both of you, for the information that you shared. A lot to digest there. But those are the committee's recommendations that Octavio shared with us, and I encourage you to read the committee's policy brief in full for further details. There's our website right there. You can access this brief along with additional information about the committee at the link on this slide. And I can answer any questions that you may have, or maybe our experts will. Our presenters will help me with this at the end of this webinar. So let's just move into that section right now. Thank you all for listening through the course of the webinar, and let's begin the Q&A, Christine.
Great. Thanks so much, Paul, and to our speakers. That was excellent information. And we will open the webinar up for questions at this time. So hopefully the Q&A box has shown up on everybody's screen in the lower right-hand corner. And go ahead and enter your questions there for our panelists. And we do have one question that came in via chat during the webinar, and it's for Marcus. And the question is, have you found any issues with internet availability and connection when implementing action communities in rural areas? How many of the communities currently involved are considered rural, and how might you define rural? So, three-part question.
Sure, sure. Great questions, and something that we're looking at much more closely. So as of right now, I have not heard specifically about issues related to internet connection, broadband, and sort of how the connectivity issues might be playing out. Of course, we know that's an issue. It just came from a wonderful presentation at the IHI, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement Forum, that wasn't on age-friendly health systems, but was with this terrific group called Last Mile Health, and they really highlighted how here, even in the United States, we have such remote areas that are facing challenges related to technology, connectivity, that it's almost as if you were in, a country more in the developing phase. So we have those issues to work with. I have not yet heard of specific examples, but I anticipate we will come up against that. And it's an issue that we'll have to think about from a policy standpoint and from just an access standpoint. In terms of how many of our age-friendly sites are technically rural and or how do we define rural? I don't have those numbers yet, but I know that as these action communities are rolling forward, and we're in the middle of one right now, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and the American Hospital Association, which is also running an action community, are collecting that kind of information. We need to be able to tell the story of who's involved, how rural or not they are, and their particular challenges. I will note that I mentioned the Geriatrics Workforce Enhancement Program funded by HRSA. There are 44 sites, 33 of those are rural, at least designated by HRSA as such. They are actually officially now coming into the Age-Friendly Health Systems Initiative as an action community, focusing on those 4 M's and doing the training. So I think we're going to learn a lot from those 33 rural, what we call GWEPs, Geriatric Workforce Enhancement Programs. The last thing I'll say is I just want to connect into one of the policy recommendations that Octavio was mentioning, telehealth becomes incredibly important. I was talking to Maine Health, a system in Maine that is in the Age-Friendly Health Systems Initiative. And while they're based in Portland, their catchment area reaches out into rural New Hampshire, and they have patients that are trying to access care. They're right now piloting telehealth as a way to implement some of the 4M's screens that they are focused on. That's going to be incredibly important. And so this recommendation from the committee about telehealth and making that viable for as many sites as possible is going to be really important.
Great, thank you. I think this next question is also for you. Are there efforts to have the Joint Commission support and include standards and specifications tied to age-friendly hospital systems as a mandated part of their accreditation requirements?
No, that's a great question. I will say that conversations are ongoing right now with accrediting bodies like the Joint Commission to explore the possibility of baking in standards related to 4M's age-friendly care. There's still a ways to go on how that might be operationalized. We want to, as I mentioned, make sure that we are not overburdening or making an initiative that's not feasible. That's why the focus is really on a framework and a way of organizing the care rather than being a specific model. But I will say stay tuned to join Friends of Age Friendly. You'll be kept up to date on how those conversations are progressing and how we might move towards a recognition and accreditation program around age-friendly health systems.
Thank you. The next question is, can you talk more about promoting healthcare workforce recruitment in rural areas, such as rural residency programs? What are the advisory committee's recommendations in that area?
Well, Christine, I'll take that one, being part of HRSA. You know, the workforce is a big part with the Bureau of Health Workforce and Health Resources and Services Administration. It has been mentioned on the webinar about the HRSA's Geriatrics Workforce Enhancement Program, and the idea of, we're not just going to have more geriatricians and more aging elderly specialists out there. It's going to be a matter of bringing it up through the workforce planning and also through our medical schools. And so there are efforts underway. When you look at the what's happening to demographics, I'm hoping that the efforts can hopefully keep up with the demographics, the changing demographics, but those are the things that are going on. I was encouraged to hear that 30 of the 44 sites that are being funded are in rural areas. That's not always the case. So many times the committee's dealt with this before, and things like block grants, how that they, funding goes to states, and then it goes to where the biggest bang for the buck is, and that's not always in the smallest rural communities. So very encouraged by that statistic that was shared.
Oh, I was just going to add, Paul, into the great question, but also the recommendation, too, on the telehealth. It really ties into that, is recognizing the need to really take advantage of technology. And right now, telehealth, telemental health, telepsychiatry, as well as even telepharmacology, but thinking about it for the needs of our elder population in rural areas where we know it's going to be very difficult to increase geriatricians or physicians concentrating on rural adults, where we can really utilize other resources through technology, and telehealth right now is really one that we need to maximize, as well as we continue to look at alternative and additional resources. Back to you, Marcus.
No, that's great, Octavio, and really great answers from both you and Paul. I'll just add in, just so people are aware, there is also a national coalition that's focused on these issues as well. It's called the Elder Care Workforce Alliance, and it's an organization of about 32 different organizations that have come together, and they are very broad and diverse, and they represent both health professionals associations, but also family caregiver groups, consumer groups, unions, and just to add in, rural is on their radar, and that coalition is at the federal level really trying to support HRSA's efforts and on the rural front as well as more broadly.
Let me add one other thing, because this is such a rich, I think, question, because the workforce really is a rate-limiting factor for our ability to respond to our communities, but it's also the consideration of really expanding and thinking about who is part of the workforce, and hence the reason we wanted to let the Secretary know that peer support, individuals with lived experience, but also individuals that can be elders themselves, who can, in fact, be part of the solution and really help their colleagues, their neighbors, and their friends, is something that we really also need to maximize, because the studies are showing that it really elevates and increases the ability for navigation and for understanding our complicated healthcare system.
Great point. The next question is, what is the thinking of accepting scientifically supported programs and recommendations from the National Prevention Councils when creating continuums of health education programs, age-friendly health systems, and community programs in rural communities? Anyone want to weigh in on that?
I'm not real familiar with that particular questioner's point of or perspective on that. What I am familiar with is, in any case, whether you're talking about the Joint Commission and with healthcare facilities, or whether you're talking about like the National Quality Forum when you're looking at quality measures, or any of these bodies, when there's an evidence base that there is there, and that you build your programs and your supports around that, you're a lot more likely to get the attention of payers. It just becomes something that they're more open to supporting when those evidence bases and that certification, I guess if you could call it, is there. And it includes the educational areas that you're talking about, that the questioner raised.
Great, thank you.
This is Marcus. Oh, and I'm sorry, I'll just add a quick, I'm not quite sure what the National Prevention Councils are, but I'm going to look that up. But I will mention just a reference to our Age-Friendly Public Health Initiative. And we're working with an organization called the Trust for America's Health, and they're tightly connected to the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force and other efforts. So I'll say through that initiative, we are trying to think about prevention wellness as a component here around age-friendly care.
Great. Thank you. The next question is, what did you uncover about caregiver availability and affordability, or the lack of caregiver resources in the areas that you did your research?
I might ask Octavio to talk about the framework that actually it was his that he came up with, the affordability, the accessibility, and the acceptability around that question, Octavio.
Sure. Thanks. Thank you, Paul. Where that framework comes from, and I think what really it speaks to, and I love the question about what we uncover about caregiver availability. What we uncovered is what heuristically I think the community really already knows, which is that the majority of caregiving is being done by family and by community. And it's not really being done in a formal fashion. And one thing we did discuss as a committee member during our site visit with our stakeholders that were present, but even afterwards as we were deliberating among ourselves and coming up with the recommendations to give to the secretary, is the fact that so many of our caregivers, there is not a formal way of providing resources, for example, to provide them and to give them a respite from taking care of their loved one or a community member. And that is woefully needed, even more so in rural areas. As we noted, a lot of resources really, unfortunately, go to urban areas or suburban areas, and we really need to include and have that rural lens and focus to additionally include the caregivers that we're seeing there. I have a feeling that the majority of folks that are online and listening to our presentation today are very much very well aware of that, and we want to know that we want you to know that as a committee, we take that also very seriously, and that's why we have included and want to ensure that we're having this discussion and getting these recommendations to the secretary. I know it's not a great answer, to tell you the truth, but it is definitely a part of the dialogue now, which I have felt historically really hadn't even been there on the radar.
And Christine, I might add that it does add to that conversation about it's not just about having age-friendly policies and also age-friendly health system. It really is about having age-friendly communities. And as we see the changing demographics in our rural areas where, the younger generations are heading to the urban areas for employment opportunities, that we see an aging, a graying of rural America where there is extra stress on the folks that are, if you will, left behind. So it's about thinking of it as a community process.
For sure. Yeah, thank you. All right, the next question is, can you talk about how the Veterans Health Administration fits into this work?
Ooh. This is Marcus. I can just briefly say that we are engaged with the VA, and they're terrific. In fact, and for many years, because they were such a source of great geriatric care. Geriatrics really was incubated in the VA. We continue a close partnership with them. So they're engaged. We're exploring with them how the VA system and healthcare can adopt the age-friendly principles. I did not mention, and won't go into too much detail, but would say that we also have very interconnected initiatives around geriatric emergency department care and geriatric surgical care that are age-friendly, that go deeper into those settings. And there we have really deep partnerships, particularly on the ED side with the VA, who is actually going to be taking up some training soon.
Great. Thank you. The next question says, we just started a project in Michigan regarding age-friendly public health system. How do we engage the local health department in the initial phase to determine level of participation engagement with aging services in their communities? And how do we make sure to implement it with a rural lens?
That's a great question, and while I can't answer it directly, I know exactly the people who can. So I mentioned in our age-friendly public health initiative, it's piloting right now in Florida, and that's where right now on the ground we have a sort of a learning lab going on with exactly that kind of engagement happening specifically between the public health departments and aging services on the ground at the county level, and some of those areas are, of course, rural in Florida. So I'd be happy to make a connection offline. I hope you've got my, or I hope you can be provided my email. I'd be happy to make connections to both the project team that's working in Florida as well as some of those Florida state officials that are there so you can learn. And go Michigan. You guys are doing all kinds of great age-friendly stuff.
Great.
Just a reminder of what my friends in Michigan already know is that what we know about rural areas, especially the smaller rural areas, is that while they are resource-restricted, they are relationship-rich. And in addition to what Marcus shared with you, I'd say go at it from a relational impact or perspective. You know these folks, and so reach out to them individually and let them know what you're working on and that you need their partnership. Many times that will then, you know, they'll share with you what they know, and you can share with them what you know, look at it from a national perspective, but move in there on a local perspective from the relationships you already have.
And can I add to Marcus and to Paul's answer? One, I think it's fabulous what you're doing there in Michigan and your approach. And I'm with Marcus. I know about the Florida initiative. So, Marcus, I'm glad you're going to provide them with those contacts. But also, don't forget the power of your local statistics and demographics in making this extremely relevant. Now, I know that sounds like, you know, very basic, but too often we actually forget about utilizing local and statewide data. National data is great, but if you can make it local and personal, then you really are able to engage your stakeholders at the local, be it at the city or county or even state level, to be able to advance your initiative.
Great. That sounds like some really good advice. So at this point, we are about at the end of our time, and so I think we'll wrap things up. On behalf of the Rural Health Information Hub, I'd like to thank our speakers for the great information and the insights that you've provided. Also, thanks to the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services as a whole for doing this important work. And also thank you to our participants for joining us. A survey will automatically open at the end of the webinar, and we encourage you to complete the survey and provide us with your feedback on what we can do in hosting future webinars to make it better. The slides used in today's webinar are currently available at www.ruralhealthinfo.org/webinars. In addition, a recording and a transcript of today's webinars will be made available on the RHI Hub website and sent to you by email in the near future so that you can listen again or share the presentation. Thank you for joining us, and have a great day.